Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, our monthly meeting, and welcome to our visitors on WIDELP. And we have today more about evolution on islands, an informal discussion with Professor Tom Givnish. So I guess he's ready for your questions.
I'm ready for your questions.
When you were talking about people's influence on the fauna and flora of islands,
yes.
I was thinking about that horrible snake.
The brown tree snake.
Yeah.
Of Guam. It got to Guam from New Guinea.
Yeah, and it's wiped out so many.
It basically killed essentially the entire land, bird, fauna. And it's also shorted out lots of transformers that creep into, and it's very nasty snake, and God forbid that it could ever get loose from Guam onto Hawaii. Several of them have been captured on the at the airport on Honolulu. You have to realize that Guam, being located where it is very strategic. And a lot of military flights especially fly through there. And the U.S. government, in my opinion, among the many immoral things it's doing, it's immoral not to have invested a few million dollars to make the areas where the containers are packed and unpacked completely safe. In other words, not out in the jungle, but isolated from sources of snakes or other creatures that might get on to planes and then drop off. If one of those snakes, just one snake that was pregnant, got off in Honolulu, it would be the end of the birds there, which are already, half of them were driven extinct by the Polynesians, half of what remains have been driven extinct by us with the introductions of avian malaria and avian pox and mosquitoes, and the rest would go almost surely.
What's the natural enemy?
Of?
The brown snake.
That's a very good question.
I don't think there are any.
It must be
in its native place.
Not necessarily.
Well, maybe a big eel or something that can...
It'd be a bigger snake.
Maybe it's its own natural enemy eating its food supply.
The other thing is that in areas where there are predators, have been for a long time, the prey animals usually evolve some sort of defenses. It could be a behavioral defense. And the birds in Hawaii have evolved without any snake predators.
So rather than the having a predator above it kill it, it's the prey below it that adapt.
That may, yes, exactly. Yeah. But I'm not certain that people have studied, say, the birds back in New Guinea where the brown snake is native, whether they have specific stratagems to avoid the snake. Don't know.
Can't be a problem at this point.
Well, in the Amazon,
yes,
some of the birds defend against snakes by building nests in trees that shed their bark every year, which means that vines cannot ascend those trees, mm-hmm, and snakes can't get up the smooth bark.
That's an interesting thought. Yes.
I have kind of a broader question, but it's kind of on the same theme about extinction.
Yes.
Obviously, extinction is a natural process.
Mm-hmm.
It's been happening ever since there was life on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd also be fair to say that extinction has been significantly influenced by man,
yes,
especially in the last 100, 150 years. But how do you strike the balance between, how do you know what causes to root for, I guess is what I'm saying. How do you know when something is naturally occurring, and that's okay, it might be sad, especially if you have an affinity with one species, and I'm thinking about the flightless parrot that you showed us earlier.
The kakapo.
Which, I love birds, and parrots especially are so intelligent, and it would be such a tragedy to see an extinction of such an unusual and intelligent creature. But I'm just wondering your thoughts on the process of extinction and when should we intervene or try to intervene? When does it not make sense to, it's more of an open-ended, I guess.
Sure.
What's your
thoughts? If you look over long periods of time, race of speciation and extinction have to be roughly in balance. Either that, or we would have either no species, or we would be, you know, billions and trillions of species. So, on average, over long periods of time, those two tend to be in equilibrium, and probably in equal, and therefore the species number is close to equilibrium. But we expect today, because of massive habitat destruction and fragmentation, that the extinction rate has gone way up. So, you could say death is a natural aspect of human life. That doesn't excuse the Holocaust, right? Where there's a huge spike in deaths caused in unnatural ways. And I think just because there are low rates of extinction, natural extinction going on, that does not excuse the possibility that, an extinction rate perhaps 1,000 times higher might occur over the next 50 years, as expected based on the amount of area that's being destroyed, say, in tropical rainforests alone. So now, as far as separating out whether natural effects are evolved, humans or both, it can be very difficult. So, for example, with the great auk, which was this large flightless seabird in the northern hemisphere, the closest we had to the penguins in the north, it's very clear that hunting greatly reduced the numbers. But then probably a volcanic explosion on the last remaining island where it was nesting blew it away. So I would say that we both, both nature and humans had a role in that. I remember once going to a lecture by Julian Simon, who was an economist and really, frankly, a very destructive person, in that he argued that more people are better for the world, because only advanced societies really take up the cause of conservation, and only if you have lots and lots of people do you get lots of technological innovation. That was his argument. And I listened to his talk at the Memorial Union, and it was just claptrap as far as biology was concerned. He had no clue what was going on. And he was basically claiming there's no evidence for extinction caused by humans and so on. And I said, look, I told him, look, I work on a group of plants, Cyanea, the genus Cyanea, where 22% of all the species that have ever been described in historic times, let's say since the mid-19th century, are extinct. So don't tell me that extinctions don't occur. And given how most of those have gone extinct, mainly through habitat destruction or through perhaps the birds going extinct, which have a variety of causes, including habitat destruction and possibly spread of disease by introduced insects, there are lots of extinctions. Now, the extinctions, I have to say, are more numerous on islands, more obvious on islands, partly because population sizes of all the organisms are much smaller there. So it takes a shorter period of time for the bad end to finally come. But, what about extinctions on mainland North America? There actually haven't been that many so far. There have been some, but not hundreds and hundreds. And partly, I have to say, the Endangered Species Act has helped greatly. If we didn't have that in place, we would have had hundreds more, I would say. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Great.
Yeah, on a personal level, without death, there wouldn't be any evolution.
Absolutely.
And we humanists may not have heaven to think about, but we do have, when we die, we've done our bit for evolution.
Well, yeah. For death to be meaningful in terms of evolution, though, it has to have occurred before the end of one's reproductive lifetime, and that includes any contribution to reproduction by being a grandparent, you know, increasing the fitness of your grandkids. So, you know, everyone's going to die, but in that sense, deaths are not selective. But to the extent that there are differential deaths before the end of reproduction that affect the rate at which different genotypes are passed into the next generation, then you are, in fact, making a contribution to evolution.
What does
positive or negative?
An island. You said islands have a lifespan. What does an island?
Well, so in the Hawaiian chain, it looks like of order 5 million years for a tall island.
Why?
Well, because that's a good question. In the Hawaiian chain and many of the other chains of islands in the Pacific Ocean, you have permanently fixed hot spots in the mantle that poke through as the crust moves past it, and forms a hot spot and creates volcanoes. And the volcanoes are only over the hot spot for a relatively brief period, maybe 500,000 to a million years. And then that's it. There might be some later eruptions, but most of the mountain building occurs then. So heap up, in the case of say, the Big Island, peaks of order 13,000 feet high above the waterline, and then more than that below the waterline. Right, so that Mauna Kea is the tallest mountain in the world if you take it from the base, much taller than Everest is. So once the island has been formed volcanically, and even indeed along the way of being formed, things start ripping it down. So erosion starts ripping it down. And
it stay as ground soil?
Well, just hold on. So one thing is just erosion. Now, initially, in fact, you don't get normal stream-driven erosion going on because the lava is so porous. So almost all the rainwater just sinks into the cracks and it doesn't really cut through erosion. Now it's dissolving the rock in the process of doing that. And in time, enough fine material gets broken off the rock internally to seal the cracks and make the rock tight, and so that it doesn't allow all the water to run down into the depths. And then it starts running across the surface, and then you get erosion taking place. And it's, you know, the erosion is both mechanical removal of material, but there's also chemical weathering that takes place. So that's one thing that happens, and it happens pretty quickly, but it doesn't happen that quickly. So if you look at the Big Island, there are very few, essentially no ravines, hardly any surface streams in the younger part of the islands down near Kilauea. But if you go up to the Kohala Mountains in the northeast, which are about 400,000 years old, you get very deep gullies. You know, they're half a mile deep. So we know approximately already, you know, how fast that's happening. Secondly, because the material that the Hawaiian Islands and many volcanic islands is very weak, sometimes whole halves of the islands just shelve off in one huge landslide. So the north part of Oahu sheared off and you know, caused this huge tsunami, obviously, in the process. But it just sheared off. And so many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years of erosion was done in one event. That's why you have, I mean, it's not just the trade winds that are cutting the northeast slopes of Oahu and Kauai, but also shearing off. And then also when the hot spot is under the volcano, the whole crust swells up. The seafloor is higher. And then as the crust moves away from the hot spot, as it goes, you know, the crust moves off to the northwest, not only does that swelling go down, but then the titanic mass of the mountain causes subsidence. And so not only is erosion and these catastrophic landslides wearing away the mountains, but also you have sinking, you have, what is it called? I forget. I can't remember. Subsidence. They have subsidence going on. So, and basically, Kauai is 5.1 million years, and then if you go, Niihau is about 5.1, 5.2. And then beyond that, there are no tall islands. There are little rocks here and there.
So volcanic structures would last longer if they were in a plain than they would in the water.
No, no, nothing I said had anything to do with them being in the water. It has to do, actually, the erosion is almost exclusively above the water line.
I just thought there'd be somewhere for it to go through or something. No.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I see what you're saying. That may be true, but basically the argument, I think, with the continental areas is just the area is so much vaster. I mean, something like 85 or 90% of the total area of the Hawaiian Islands is in the Big Island, and that's only about 50 miles across. So,
and it still goes down underwater.
And it goes down underwater. But then, you know, if you go off to the northwest and look at these geos, these seamounts below the waterline, basically they've lost the top plus some because, you know, the water level has gone up and down over time. You know, there's the glaciers. Mm-hmm. But then the footprint is still there. You know, the seamount hasn't really eroded very much.
So it'll be there for a while.
Well, apparently for 80 million years, which is, and we don't, could have been there longer, but then at 80 million years, they go down into the chute at the Aleutian Trench and get fed back into the mantle. So
it was 80 million years ago, there was a lot of life on those islands, those big islands, right?
Conceivably. Yeah. I mean, our understanding of this has changed greatly in the last 15 years in that we now know that between Kauai and Gardner, there was a bit of a gap of tall islands. Mm-hmm. And then before Gardner, there's a long gap where there are very few, there were no tall islands produced, only about islands 500 to 1,000 meters above sea level. And it's thought that that gap between Gardner, which is about 13 or 14 million years, to the seamount Koko, which is right at the elbow of the Hawaiian Emperor seamount chain, which is about 40 million years old, that would have been a bad time for the biota in the Hawaiian Islands because the wettest forest would not have been there at all. And in many cases, the islands were produced too far apart for dispersal to have worked as well as it does today.
Just spend some time talking about dwarfism versus giantism.
Yes, okay. So there are a number of cases in island animals, like the tortoises on the Galapagos Islands, where species have obviously become much larger. And there are other cases, for example, elephants or rhinoceri on Sumatra or Bali, where they've become much smaller. And the argument for the gigantism generally is that the large terrestrial herbivores that would eat grasses or shrubs simply were unable to make it to the islands, but there are resources that they would feed on that are present for which large body sizes would be adaptive. And you've had selection for, you know, large size in say, tortoises. And furthermore, people might argue that on the drier islands or islands that have a less predictable environment, that larger body sizes are better, for the same reason that larger body sizes are adaptive at high latitudes, because there's a lower metabolic rate associated with per unit body mass associated with big body size. And that means that a large body loses less of its weight per day proportionally than a small body does. And so during long periods of winter, the animals are better off and they're able to conserve their energy. And the same argument could be made for, say, tortoises in the arid Galapagos Islands. As far as dwarfism is concerned, always this is talked about with regard to animals that were large to begin with that got to islands. And there the argument, I guess, is that islands are really small, and they're really, really small for big animals because big animals have got big territories. And
resource-wise.
Yeah, resource-wise, and so you know, if Bali could only, you know, fit 30 full-sized elephants, well, that might not be enough to ensure the long-term survival of. And elephants may have colonized several times, and only the times that involved smaller animals survived.
You're intelligent,
isn't it? No, I'm not.
You're intelligent,
isn't it? Trial and error.
price. Trial and error is doing the designing.
So trial and error is doing the designing. Indian elephants are smaller than African elephants?
No, I wasn't saying that at all. India is not an island. But I was talking about Indonesian elephants, and they are substantially smaller. So
smaller
Sumatra, what's that?
Smaller than the Indian elephants?
Much smaller. Much smaller.
Are
they a different species?
I'm not sure what they're recognized as, whether it's recognized as a subspecies or a species. I think.
You never hear about them.
Yeah.
What size are they?
Well, I think they're of order 40% smaller, something like that. So they're quite a bit smaller.
Yeah. So pony size?
No, they're not quite pony or musk oxen size. Yeah. Cute little mini mammoths. No, they're still. Definitely pachyderms. They're still, you know,
still
large. Still large.
40% smaller than the smaller elephant, or the yet larger one.
The smaller elephants, let's say, 40% smaller.
40% in weight, or
in weight? In weight, not in height. No.
And can DNA reconstruct any of these lost creatures?
Well, that's what hope is. So, if you go to Tasmania, for example, a wonderful island, which I highly recommend going to at some point in your life. You'll find that the Tasmanians are just wild about Tassie, which is their nickname for the Tasmanian tiger. The Tasmanian tiger. And this was, I have a film clip actually I could show at the end here. But this is a rather wolf-like creature, but was close relative of kangaroos. So it's a marsupial. And it behaved just like, we have film strips from the 20s when they were still around. They behave quite a bit like a dog. And the only thing is their hindquarters are striped. Hence the name Tasmanian tiger. And the gape is enormous. They can go beyond a dog's gape like this to like this. They were hunted ruthlessly. And it was just, you know, bloody-mindedness by the Tasmanians. They weren't losing very much to these creatures, which weren't that common to begin with. But they blew them all away. But now, you know, the license plate has got the Tasmanian tiger on it. For years, they've been talking about the Natural History Museum extracting DNA from baby Tasmanian tigers that they had preserved in alcohol to get the whole sequence and then to try to recreate them. You know, in the long term, I think actually there are a few creatures like the Tasmanian tiger, like woolly mammoths, that could be brought back because we have excellent samples. And if you have a number of excellent samples, you probably could patch together the DNA. But it's not going to happen today. It's not going to happen this decade. It's not going to happen probably for 50 or 60 years.
Maybe it'll happen when people care about
crews. I think they care enough now. Let's put it this way. It's much simpler to conserve the species to begin with than to try to pull Lazarus on them. It's very, very hard. And, you know, until it's done, no one knows that it can be done.
I was in New Zealand about 8 years ago. And one thing I came away from that country was their really passionate devotion to environmentalism.
Yes.
And you seem to be indicating with that parrot that they're continuing on with it.
Absolutely. I mean,
spending lots of money, spending a long period of time.
Huge amount of manpower put into it as well. The Kiwis, you know, the New Zealanders are just heroic in their attempts now to conserve biodiversity. They put us to shame, frankly.
Yeah, I was like, they were spending relatively large amount. So
very large fraction.
Country,
very large fraction.
The United States can barely spend even as much as they do with their
country.
Right now, as you know, we have an administration that basically is undercutting at every possible turn.
Doesn't believe in science.
Is undercutting conservation at every possible turn. Now, when you realize that, first major conservationist in this country who got to political power was Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican. I think you should, recognize that conservation is something that should not be a partisan issue. But today, it is, of all of the issues, it is the single most partisan issue. If you look at...
stem cell?
I would say so. So in other words, if you look at... if you look at you know, conservation scores, Republican scores average around 15, whereas Democratic scores average around 75 to 80. And you know, after the last election, one compares the people who were thrown out and or were replaced as chairs. The average score of the Republicans being replaced was 8 versus 88. So it is the biggest divide, and there's no reason for it. I don't really understand, except it's mindless, you know, market-driven philosophy. It's Friedmanology has won, despite the fact that Friedmanology should never have won. It's not really legitimate intellectually.
It's a question of mentality too, because I mean, when I was in New Zealand, they had projects that must have taken a good 15, 20 years to complete.
Oh yes.
And we don't seem to have that mentality here. I mean, they're just beginning cleaning the lakes.
Well, I will say, you know, I've been to many places in the U.S. where there are very highly dedicated people working in conservation, and that includes Hawaii. Very, very highly dedicated people. The resources, however, are not being deployed by the state or by the federal government to match the enthusiasm of those people. Now, you ask whether on islands generally there is this conservation ethic that the New Zealanders have. I will say, first of all, that conservation ethic was surely not there 100 years ago, you know, when a lot of things were being extirpated. It certainly was not there when the Polynesians arrived, when the Maoris arrived. They slaughtered every single last one of those moas. So it's not necessary. On the other hand, you know, there are a number of island cultures. People have written about this, say, in terms of the taboo systems in Polynesia and similar systems in New Guinea, which tend to prevent the human population from overrunning its resources. You might expect that on islands there would be faster feedback between people making colossally stupid moves ecologically and all dying. So you could see how it would be more likely to evolve there. But there are plenty of island societies that are just do absolutely terrible things. So Round Island, which is an island off of Mauritius, you know, colonized by the Dutch and East Indians, they just ran that place literally into the ground. There is nothing left. It's all rock. And now it's the largest ecological restoration effort in the world, where they're trying to terraform Round Island to get the soil back. They ran it so bad that all the soil washed away.
This is a Dutch.
And there are formerly, I think Mauritius is now independent. But formerly there are soils there, and I think, you know, it got down to the point there were one or two of the palm trees left when they said, you know, maybe we should start doing something about this. And, you know, there are lots of other places. The Philippines, you know, are quite happily cutting down all of their rainforests. And Indonesia, you know, they have lots of national parks. I've been to small parts of Indonesia. The people don't get it. They don't really understand what impact people can have and how large numbers of people poaching and, you know, squatting national parks and forests are not compatible with preserving wildlife or plants. So I don't really see that. I don't really see the noble islander phenomenon.
Easter Island is another example.
Easter Island, yes, for just to quote one, yes, right.
Is Indonesia the densest, most densely populated place in the world?
Only parts of it. So Bali is. I think the most densely populated part of the world. But that's only a tiny fly speck of an island compared with the enormous area of Indonesia. So there are many areas that have lower population density, much lower population density.
I was thinking of the population in relation to the decimation of resources.
It goes way beyond that, because there are many areas that are very low human population densities now, where they're simply cutting the forests and, you know, the orangutan.
So you're saying the big interests doing this on a large scale are much more detrimental than even a large number of, say, poor people gathering firewood?
I don't think there's any doubt that human impacts on ecosystems are a function of A, density, B, intensity of resource use, and C, what we often overlook is movement, human movement. As we move around, we're introducing lots of exotic animals and plants, and they're having enormously detrimental effects. If you go to Hawaii, you go to New Zealand, you see most of the catastrophes are actually caused not by global warming, and in some cases not even by outright habitat destruction, but because someone brought in weasels, right, to New Zealand, or they brought in mongoose to Hawaii, or cattle, goats, pigs to Hawaii. People extol all the advantages of global trade and say nothing about the downsides. And there are many downsides in terms of the spread of exotic species being foremost. But then, secondly, if global trade is used as an excuse, it is being used today by this administration to lower environmental standards to the lowest common denominator. That's doing a lot of damage as well.
But they're lining their pockets.
Would you speak
or their friends' pockets.
The pig issue.
Yes.
Is there something to do about the pigs in Hawaii? Because I haven't sent money to Nature Conservancy because they trap them and leave them to die in the traps. They don't go back and get them out.
Well, I'm aware there are many people who feel the way you do, and let me just say a few things about that. First of all, I've been to many of the places where the Nature Conservancy has had to resort to noose traps on Molokai. The terrain is like nothing you have ever been on. It is extremely steep. It is so steep, and the forests are so dense, that if you take your dogs out, you will lose your dogs, and you will never get them back. It is not possible to go out and organize a hunt there to shoot them out. The nooses are the snares are being used only as a last resort, and they do that only when they have isolated parcels of land with pig-proof fence, and they've done as much hunting as they can, and then they get the last few out with the snares. Now, having said that, no one debates that snares are not nice, that they don't cause suffering. They certainly cause death. That's the desired end, is to cause death, but they also do cause suffering. But the reality is, these introduced animals are killing all the birds. They're killing most of the plants. Unless we get rid of them, that's the end. That's the end. They'll never exist again. And for me and for most of the people I know in conservation, there is no question but that you should kill a few pigs. And I'm sorry, but I disagree with you on this. I think that it is cruel. It is cruel.
Is there any way you can retrieve the snares with the pig in them?
Again, you have no concept of how rugged the terrain is. It takes enormous. What's that?
They
put in a couple of days to get there and get back, and you can't if you're gonna police a snare, you better be there every other day, or the animal will maybe eat its leg off or something like that, or it will die, and so it is impossible. The resources are simply not. And also, if it were possible, then you'd be tracking in all sorts of exotic species into these otherwise very remote areas. So. Mm-hmm. I would urge you to give to the Nature Conservancy,
accept that as a price.
There is a price, but I do think it's an acceptable price in this one case.
Rose had a question. Could we let Rose ask
the
question?
Thank you.
Sorry, Rose.
I think the real elephant in the room is global warming and the possibility that islands will be inundated completely and everything on them. And also coastal parts of countries and many species are vulnerable to what's going on now.
Yes. So that's true. And there are two things involved here. One is the inundation aspect, and low-lying islands like those in the Maldives chain, some of the atolls in the Southwest Pacific are particularly at risk. The good news is that those very low-lying chains have very few species that are not found elsewhere, including on other islands that are taller. And the reason is that they're so low that they're very dry, and almost all the plants that get there on the sea drift. You know, they float the seeds over there. So it's very bad. You know, if you're a Maldive islander, it's very seriously bad. I mean, we've already lost one or two islands in that chain, and they're going to continue to lose a lot of islands, and there are going to be several islands lost in the Pacific. But from a biological conservation point of view, it's not a big deal. More important is the global warming, because what will happen is that some on the tallest islands, some of the unique alpine environments will simply disappear. They'll simply be replaced by warmer, low elevation. And, you know, often, certainly in the Hawaiian Islands, as you move from the lowest elevation along the shore to the upper elevations, you get a peak at mid to high elevations in the proportion of species that are endemic, or let's say limited to individual islands. And so there may be fewer species if you get higher enough elevation, but they're still only found on those individual islands. So you're going to lose a lot through the global warming aspect. But again, that's happening right now, right? You know, in Madison, you know, the temperature has gone up of order 3 or 4 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970, looking at the data. And the rate of increase here in the Midwest is as high as any place in the U.S. except for Alaska. Yeah, again, exotic species are pressing right now as being very, very important.
The species that are creeping northward because of global warming and wiping out are devastating forests.
Yes.
You really see it in Alaska.
Yeah. So you see that in Alaska. But on the other hand, you know, I'm going to be taking my class down to the Great Smokies in about a month and a half. And the Great Smokies are the center of plant and animal diversity in eastern North America. Heavy rainfall, diverse geological substrates, and great diversity of topography. And I'm not looking forward to it, to be honest, because I'm expecting that roughly half of the hemlock forests, which are the oldest forests there, will be dead now. And they will have died since I was there 2 years ago. And that's not because of global warming. That's because of the hemlock woolly adelgid introduced from overseas. You know, I was just talking with some friends about, should we go on this trail, which has, you know, lots of tall trees. And I said, well, go, but you have to steel yourself because all the hemlocks are gone, and including the national, the world champion in terms of tallest hemlock known. It's all, they're all dead. And the same thing happened 20 years ago, 25 years ago, with Fraser fir. And you go there now. I mean, I remember as a lad going down to the Smokies as a freshman in college and thinking these Fraser fir forests were some of the most beautiful forests I'd ever seen in North America. And they still remain that in my memory after I've seen more forests than your average bear. And they're gone. The only place where they're not gone is where the conditions are too harsh and the trees haven't grown up to the point where the bark splits and the adelgids can get into the cracks. There are juveniles that have come up. There's a whole new wave underneath that's coming up. But the question is whether they will produce cones and set seed before they get killed, or whether we're simply going to lose that species. And then before that, of course, there was a chestnut.
Yeah.
And, you know, right now in New England, sugar maples are getting hammered by pear thrips. It made a host shift from pears trees over to sugar maples. Who would have thought? Mm-hmm. And you know all about the emerald ash borer on the scene. Yeah, exactly. And Dutch elm, yeah.
I was just reading yesterday about the white bark pine, which is an ancient tree in California.
Yeah.
And that's now vulnerable to an insect that's
Yeah.
Spreading into that altitude because of global warming.
There's that, but also, you know, white bark pine and also alder tree by far, bristlecone pine, both of them are white pines, are highly susceptible to white pine rust. Now, that was introduced at some 20 points on the East Coast and really did a number on our white pines, but it seems to have recovered now, partly through hacking out the alternative host in lots of places. But on the West Coast, it was introduced one place, but now it's sweeping through into the Rockies, and it's just about to intersect with the Rocky Mountain populations of bristlecone pine. Now, that, they're not the oldest trees on Earth. The oldest ones are down the White Mountains of California. But the Rocky Mountain ones are close, you know, 3,000 or more years old. They're going to die. And it has nothing to do with global warming. It has to do with untrammeled global trade. No concern. You know, I go to Hawaii frequently. I have yet to get on a flight of United or any other airline that says a word about why you should not bring anything exotic into Hawaii. I've yet to see them show a film clip that conveys the wonder of the flora and the fauna there and how sensitive they are to introductions. There, and also, if you get off the plane in Hawaii, you just stroll out to your car, man. You rented it, you get to your car, you're off there. You come back, you have to go through all sorts of inspections. Why? Because the people in California, the farmers in California, don't want you bringing fruit flies back from Hawaii that will affect the orange crop. Where's the sense of balance? Where is the value, if any, that's placed on nature? I would say there's not any value being placed on nature at all there.
Actually, that was going to be my kind of follow-up question to that. Going back to your three impacts on islands and really on probably the world, the movement of people.
Yep.
I was very distressed a number of years ago it was almost like they touted it, Master and Commander, that movie.
Yes.
Was the first film ever filmed in the Galapagos Islands. And I thought, is this a good thing? No. I'm picturing, you know, cigarette butts from the crew littering the island or whatever. Yeah. But anyway, I'm just wondering what can be done in the movement of people, because I think that's a huge threat, not just to plant ecology and animals, but in a lot of different ways, diseases, I mean, you name it, just the mass movement of people.
Well, that's an excellent, and of materials, because the organisms go along with the materials.
Right.
We didn't get zebra mussels in the Great Lakes because of people moving. It was the ships moving that and the ballast in the ships that did it. So you raise a very important question. I think one answer is, and this may be news to everybody, but the problem will solve itself very soon, one way or the other.
Yeah.
One way is through what's called biotic impoverishment and homogenization, where we lose lots of species around the world, we lose the things that are unique to different parts of the world, and we get a few weeds that get along well with humans.
They're like the Starbucks of the plant kingdom.
That's right. But maybe an even down market version of Starbucks.
McDonald's.
Right. Even further. You know. So the other way it might, and again, maybe this is news to people, but you know, there's a limit to how much longer cheap air travel is going to be on the market. I mean, environmentalists have got a problem since Paul Ehrlich overpromised or overprophesied in the 70s ecological doom. But you know, it's pretty clear that we're at or very close to peak oil production in the whole world. And we'll see what Virgin Atlantic's experiments with biofuels on jets work out to be. But you know, the first thing that's going to be sacrificed, the first thing that's most sensitive to shortage of oils is going to be air travel. There's very few energy sources have the power density per kilogram of fossil fuel, and I think basically the money is going to reduce that. Second point I would make is, okay, Master and Commander wasn't a nature film, but one of the advantages of nature films, which go to these remote areas, is that they bring some sense of wonder about these places to the average person, so they don't have to go. And they might care enough to help protect it.
You don't think that would build the tourist industry?
It might, but like I said, I think you also have to have backing for conservation. I think they do build that, and they remove the necessity to go there. And in many cases, the nature filled people are not people who are dropping litter or having heavy impacts.
We were in Madagascar last fall, and it was a AAAS trip.
Good for you.
With a lot of talk about conservation and the government's determination to set aside and restore, maintain their national parks, and we visited about six different national parks, which were fabulous. But the argument for doing this is that then you develop an ecotourism, and if you don't get the tourists, there's not going to be the popular support for this, and and at the same time, in Madagascar, the culture is very pro-family.
Yes.
And people have large families. It does not occur to them that they should have smaller families.
Yeah.
So the population is expanding. The arable land is being quickly used up, and they're trying to preserve these beautiful regions. So it seems like it's a rather dismal.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see a way out of that particular disaster in the making.
So the other element that we haven't talked about is population.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Well, before we get to population, let me say this: that one of the downsides to my way of thinking of having an appalling conservation policy in place in this country right now.
What policy is that?
Appalling.
What policy?
None, and with the prejudice.
I'm not aware of any policy.
Okay, none with prejudice. Is it, if we, as one of the richest countries on earth, basically sacrifice everything to mammon, what possible argument can we make to other people who live far, far closer to the line than we do? And again, you've been to Madagascar, so you've seen the low standard of living that people have to survive in. I've been to many parts of the world, in South America, for example, where the living standard of the average person is well below what you see in most of this country. And so the living standard of the lowest is way, hugely below anything in this country. It just is reprehensible, the sort of excuse that we're for not doing anything that we're providing to these other countries.
And of course, as a tourist, it makes you feel very ambivalent about what you're doing, because you're staying in a nice hotel, and sure, that's providing jobs.
Yeah, I know, and you burned a lot of jet fuel
to get there. Much.
Will Bhutan be successful with their ecotourism? Or
Don't know anything about it. Sorry.
Where they're limiting the number of people but charging them a lot.
Well,
yeah.
To come in.
That makes sense.
I think that makes sense, yeah.
Plus, once they make a nature film for the rest of us.
Yeah, well, there aren't. Yeah. It's apparently one of the most difficult places to get permission to travel to.
Really?
In an interest of protecting their ecological diversity. And of course, now have a substantial portion of their national revenue. Coming from tourist industry, but they pride themselves in trying to create that with a low impact.
Well, that would be good. That would be good. But on the other hand, we run hundreds of flights per day to Hawaii, and you have to realize that most of those people are there for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to get sun on the beach and drink Mai Tais in the evening. And yet, there's a cost, right? There's a huge environmental cost of increased risk, increased destruction. But there's no connection made between the two. That there's a responsibility that should be met. Like, if you put a $5 tax on every landing that was put into the environment, that would go a very long way to solving the immediate tactical needs.
But they're not. Taxes.
But no one is going to put a $5 tax in. No one wants to pay for anything.
Nobody wants.
And that's.
Taxes,
but that's just. Yeah. That's. I mean, that's even worse. I mean, you were talking about grim futures. What about the grim future of this country, where the electorate is infantilized to the point where they can't make a connection between what you pay and what you get?
That brings up education.
Surcharges.
Say what?
They're accepting the fuel surcharges because they have no choice on the planes. But if you would make a comparable environmental surcharge, there would be a lot of screaming.
Well, I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
Do you know anything about the Chinese?
But Henry has
Henry.
A question.
Henry. Oh. Sorry. This is kind of more back to the evolution part
yes,
of it.
Yes, exactly.
I was wondering if maybe you know what kind of time span it takes for species to move from, like say, the pigeon to the dodo.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, how much actual genetic change there is there.
All right, well, that's an excellent question. So in the case of the dodo and the solitaire diverged, it is estimated, something like 23 million years ago from the populations that gave rise to them or to the Nicobar pigeon off of Southeast Asia. So, you know, both populations have been diverging since, right? So you have to keep that in mind. Furthermore, and more importantly, in terms of the evolution of flightlessness in both the solitaire and the dodo, the individual islands in the Mauritius chain only last, again, a few million years. So the evolution of flightlessness has got to have occurred in the last million years or so. And, given, again, the rate at which beak size has been shown to shift in the Galapagos finches, given the rate at which, the benthic and limnetic forms diverged in the Canadian lakes, it's entirely possible for that sort of thing to happen. Certainly it happened in Hawaii, where the flightless geese are, you know, on the Big Island, they're on Maui, and those islands are only, you know, 500,000 to 1.5 million years old. So that happens very short. In the group I work on, the Lobeliads, it looks like you swing up to about 15 or 17 species of Cyanea in about 1.2 million years. So that gives you some idea of how fast it occurs. In other groups, like the tortoises, it looks like they're slower. Surprise, surprise. It took them over 10 million years to diverge. But, of course, that means they had to do some scrambling. Somehow they had to, paddle over to other islands because, again, the oldest island is only 3.5 million years old. So they may have arrived, but they had to sometimes swim. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
And so, in terms of genetic difference between the two morphologies, what... I mean, you think... When you think of evolution, you think, it's a really energy-consuming, time-consuming process, and it's not something that happens sort of overnight.
Sure. So... In many of these island radiations, there's little genetic difference. In other words, if you look, one of the problems we have trying to study evolution is getting enough genetic variation in the DNA to figure out the relationships, precisely among all the species present. We have to do a lot of sequencing, in other words, to get enough data to actually do the kinds of analysis I've been talking about. What that's saying is that... there's only been a short amount of time, only a few genetic changes have occurred. But on the other hand, only a few genetic changes are necessary. So in the case of beak size and shape in Darwin's finches, in the last 4 years, people have done a lot of, maybe 8 years I guess now, have done a lot of genomic analyses of what genes are involved in changing among the species the length of the beak, the width of the beak. Of course, there's also the depth of the beak. And they found that just modulating two genes and their expression, namely calmodulin, which is a calcium-binding enzyme that's very important for morphogenesis in vertebrates, because of the calcium in the bones, and then bone morphological protein 3 or 4, I forget which one it is. Those two things together, just by modulating how much is expressed or when it's expressed in development can create very different beak sizes. And they've shown that by infecting, essentially by transforming chicken embryos with the genes involved using retroviruses, you know, putting the DNA into their into different parts of their snout, and showing that in fact it, it does lengthen or shorten the beak, or make it wider or narrower.
So expression is clearly when you get the beak size changing within just
yes.
months or years. I mean, it's got to be.
And you've got to make sure that it's not just plasticity.
And going back again, it must just be. I mean, the genes haven't changed. It's the expression of the genes at that point.
Well, there is some difference in expression. Remember, I showed you that relationship between what the young are versus what the parents are. There is a correlation each year, but the level of that line changes a bit.
Because of expression.
So, but there's also genetic change.
So do we know what influences the expression? Of which are, what are there some environmental factors that are what feedback is getting to the that changes the amount of expression of one gene or another?
That's a good question, and one that biologists like to avoid. even raising.
Are you talking about cause and effect here?
No, she is. She is. She's asking, you know, to what extent are the differences you see, say, across years due to changes in the environment as opposed to changes in the genes or possibly other things. I don't know what you have in mind. But say, for example, we know for certain fish that if you feed them different kinds of food, that their jaw morphology as they grow up is different than it would be with a different kind of feed.
Well, it's like someone who exercises versus someone who doesn't.
That's right. Or, you know, if we were having this conversation in 1700, we'd all be 6 inches shorter, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because we would have had far less abundant food. Mm-hmm. So there's that, but beyond that, beyond like how much food you get, it might be the kind of food you get. And the kind of food you get may be, you know, a function of who are you competing with? Mm-hmm. And so it gets rather complicated. And there's also the question of, you know, how much of the divergence do you see among species is genetic and how much is environmental? We know environment and genes are involved in every, you know, phenotype. But, you know, in adaptive radiations, almost invariably different species grow in different environments. So is it because they grow in different environments that their beaks are different? And until you do those experiments, you do common garden experiments, you can't really tell that. Now, in the case, say, of the Hawaiian lobeliads, we've done common garden experiments looking at photosynthetic responses. Some species are dense shade, some intermediate shade, some out in bright sunlight. And we find, first of all, in the field, there are big differences in photosynthetic physiology. And they appear to be adaptive in the sense that the species out in sunlight do better in sunlight than species from shade would, given their physiology as expressed in the shade environment and vice versa. But then when we do common gardens, we find that a lot of those differences persist in the common gardens, that, you know, if we raise the species up under the same conditions, that, you know, again, the sun species do better in bright light than the shade species do, and the shade species do better than the sun species do in dim light. So it's a difficult question. I think it's an extremely important question. But again, most evolutionary biologists don't pay attention, so good for you.
Well, we've come to the end of an hour, so let's thank Professor Givnish for this interesting hour.